Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Who is the greatest African Premier League player of all time? See if your choice made our list on Match of the Day Africa Top 10, a new podcast from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Brandt, and in the early hours of Sunday the 9th of July, these are our main stories. A Sudanese army airstrike has killed more than 20 people in Omdurman. President Zelensky has marked 500 days since Russia's invasion by visiting Snake Island, the enduring symbol of Ukrainian defiance. And the head of the UN nuclear watchdog has faced protests in Seoul as he seeks to calm fears over the release of contaminated water from Japan's Fukushima nuclear plant. Also in this podcast, there's new research on snakes. Turns out they're more social than we thought. We start in Sudan. Medics say more than 20 people have been killed by an army airstrike in Omdurman. Witnesses say women and children are among the dead. The fighting there is intensifying as the conflict between rival military factions enters its fourth month. Repeated mediation efforts have failed. A journalist in Omdurman, Zainab Mohamed Salih, told the BBC what it was like.
There's a fighter jet over me just now, and they come all the time, actually, since like 5 a.m. in the morning until like the sunset. And sometimes last night, for example, they were even at night, which is unusual. And then the fighter jet, I guess it's a Russian made or a Chinese one, I'm not sure. They come, they're very, very fast and come and hit. And we always hear back the RSF firing back anti-aircraft as well. And you could see it as well after the sunset. You'd see it because they look like stars, you know, on the skies.
I asked our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, what more do we know about this latest attack?
So the official line came from the Ministry of Health saying 22 people were killed and dozens injured. But after that came out, there was then a statement from the Rapid Support Forces, the paramilitary unit that's fighting against the army. And it said that the number killed was higher than that. And it said that all of the victims were civilians. It's difficult to take that as, at face value, because that's obviously one of the sides fighting in the war. But eyewitnesses in the area of Omdurman have spoken of civilian deaths, including women and children. So it does appear to be one of the worst incidents during this three-month war. And this is an airstrike by the Sudanese military as it tries to dislodge the RSF from these areas that it controls in Omdurman, in that northern area of Khartoum.
I mean, we've had repeated attempts at ceasefires, but nothing is working. Any sign at all that any kind of further effort is going to be successful?
No sign of that as yet. We understand that IGAD, which is the East African regional body, it's trying to get people to talk again on Monday in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. But we've also heard from a spokesman for the Sudanese military leader, General Al-Burhan, saying that he won't be attending those talks. So that looks like, getting off to a bad start already. And worryingly, we're hearing of all kinds of atrocities going on in the Darfur region of western Sudan, as well as North Kordofan, an area called Bara. And there are reports of, again, ethnic killings by the RSF, but also attacks on homes and banks and businesses being looted.
Will Ross on Sudan. Rival sides in politically divided Libya have agreed to set up a committee to oversee the sharing of oil revenues. One of the country's most influential military figures, Khalifa Haftar, had threatened to force the shutdown of oil production unless the UN-backed Tripoli-based government agreed to address the issue. Mike Thompson has more.
Libya sits on Africa's biggest oil reserves, which provide the main source of revenue for the country. But friction between rival administrations in the East and the West have severely hampered production. It's hoped the agreement to form the new committee will help ease tensions and soon enable Libya to double its oil output. The country has been plagued by unrest since a NATO-backed revolt in 2011 toppled former dictator Muammar Gaddafi. Elections aimed at uniting Libya, set for late 2021, were scuppered after rows over electoral rules and who should be allowed to stand.
Saturday marked 500 days since a group of Ukrainian soldiers stood on Snake Island and refused to surrender as the Russian Navy approached. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky paid a visit to the Black Sea island, praising their bravery and declared Ukraine would never be conquered. President Zelensky posted a video message after his visit.
Dear Ukrainians, I wish you good health. Today we are on Snake Island, on our Snake Island, which will never be conquered by the occupiers like the whole of Ukraine, because we are a country of the brave.
Earlier, I spoke to our correspondent, Gordon Carrera, who's in Kyiv.
At the very start of the Russian invasion last February, Snake Island was held by Ukraine, obviously, and a Russian warship approached and ordered Ukrainian border guards to surrender, and a Ukrainian border guard told the Russian warship to go away in no uncertain terms and using rather stronger language than that. And this was seen as a kind of symbol of resistance of an individual to a Russian warship. After that, the island was taken by the Russians, but eventually the Ukrainians recaptured it. And so it has become this powerful symbol for Ukraine about the ability to both resist and to retake territory that the Russians had once occupied.
And it fits in very much with Zelensky's approach of having these almost kind of, I mean, theatrical moments, maybe, that are deep in symbolism.
That's absolutely right. I mean, part of it, of course, is to his own public to keep up morale, but it's really also directed at the world and particularly at allies and particularly in NATO and Western countries, because he knows how important it is to sustain that support from other countries, to sustain it even as the war goes on, and as the counteroffensive, as he's acknowledged himself, has been slow as Ukraine tries to push back Russian forces.
In that day-to-day fighting, we hear that 8 people have been killed in the eastern town of Liman today in rocket attacks. That appears to be a kind of major strategic rail hub. What's the extent of the damage there?
Yes, it looks like quite extensive damage in a residential area in Liman, which is out in the east of the country, the result of a strike, part really of the signs that the battles are going on across that front. We're certainly hearing about pockets of fighting, but not yet a kind of significant breakthrough yet from the Ukrainian forces.
And these cluster bombs that President Biden has decided to send to Ukraine, have we heard anything from President Zelensky in terms of reaction? And can you just tell us as well, why are they so needed for Ukraine's military?
Well, military analysts here will say that they do have a value, that particularly as they're trying to break down those Russian defensive lines, they can be used to target both the infantry and the artillery behind the minefields, which would then allow minefields to be cleared and then allow the Ukrainians to try and advance and make a breakthrough. So they see military value despite the controversy over them, because, of course, many, many countries have banned their use, more than 120 countries, because of the risk to civilians in the long term. So it is controversial, but the Ukrainian argument is that they're defending their own territory. The Russians, they say, have been using these cluster munitions, so Ukraine should be able to use them in a controlled manner for its own self-defence on its territory.
Gordon Carrera in Kyiv. In a statement later on Saturday, President Zelensky said he had returned home from a visit to Turkey with 5 Ukrainian commanders captured by Russia after the siege of Mariupol in May last year. The commanders, who held out for weeks in the tunnels under the Azovstal industrial plant, had been transferred to Turkey under a prisoner swap brokered by Ankara in September. A photo showed Mr. Zelensky posing alongside the men on board a plane. The circumstances, though, of their homecoming are unclear, as the original deal obliged them to remain in Turkey. Now, in Asia, South Korea has asked the UN's nuclear watchdog to help reassure its public about the safety of treated radioactive water from Japan. Hundreds of people protested in Seoul on Saturday against Tokyo's plan to release the water from the wrecked Fukushima nuclear plant into the sea. The head of the IAEA, Rafael Grossi, who's in South Korea, says there'll be a negligible impact on people and the environment. He held talks with the foreign minister, who told him the contaminated water must be verified for safety in line with international law. James Kumarasamy heard more from our Asia Pacific regional editor, Michael Bristow, who's in Seoul.
The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, is in Seoul. But if he needed a reminder of how passionate people are against the release of that water, then he got one as soon as he arrived in town. As soon as he arrived at the airport, there was a protest and he had to leave by the side door. And on Saturday, there have been numerous protests across the cities, some small, some large. And essentially, they're all expressing the same thing. They are trying to persuade Japan to suspend, to postpone, to cancel this release of water. So you see speakers, people have been holding up placards. One protest I saw, people were holding up cutouts of fish, essentially to make the point that it's the seafood industry that's going to be damaged the most. And in one incident outside the Japanese embassy here in Seoul, a politician, Lee Jong-mi, the leader of the Small Justice Party here in South Korea, for the last 13 days, she's been sitting outside the embassy there on hunger strike, essentially. That's how passionate people are. And I had a chat with her, and this is what she had to say.
There are many people in South Korea who oppose the release of contaminated water from Fukushima. And even though the IAEA report has come out, the agency has made it clear that it's not taking political responsibility for the release. Instead of discharging the water into the sea, we should find a way to deal with it that's better for humanity, and that's by storing it on land.
So that's one hunger-striking opposition politician. But what's the government in Seoul saying?
Well, the government in Seoul essentially endorses Japan's plan to release the water. In May, the South Korean government sent over its own scientists to have a look around the Fukushima plant. They've come back and analysed what they've found, and so that's their conclusion. It's partly, mostly driven by science, but also there's a political element to this as well, because the South Korean government under President Yoon Suk-yeol has made it his mission this year to try and improve ties with Japan, which have been pretty poor over the last few years. And so to complain about the release of water would have sort of gone against that political aim that the president had. But he's come under a lot of pressure from opposition politicians, like we heard there, and people. 4 out of 5 people here, opinion polls suggest, are just against the release of water.
Michael Brister in Seoul. Snakes, particularly venomous ones, are often viewed as solitary creatures, lacking things like friendship. However, a new study suggests they may sometimes need social contact just as much as we do. Stephanie Prentice reports.
The distinctive sound of a rattlesnake's tail, meaning go away. But a new study by researchers in California suggests the creatures may need to be near other snakes for comfort as well as support. In their research, scientists discovered that snakes who underwent stressful situations with a companion remained calmer than those who endured the same situation by themselves. It's the first peer-reviewed study showing what's called social buffering among reptiles. Chelsea Martin worked on the study out of Loma Linda University.
You know, this is something that humans do as well. Humans socially buffer lots of other species that are typically considered to be social, like other mammals, birds, fishes. It's even been reported in termites. So I think that for us as humans, it lets us know that, hey, we're not that different from these snakes.
The idea for the experiment was hatched by Professor William Hayes after he was often called out to help people deal with snakes found in their houses. He noticed that rattlesnakes placed in a bucket together stopped rattling, and later in lab tests measured lower heart rates among snakes in stressful situations when they were all grouped together. Professor Hayes says the findings can be used as part of a wider movement towards viewing reptiles as more sentient.
You know, through decades back, yeah, they were definitely thought of as automatons. You know, they simply respond to stimuli, and they weren't capable of thinking or processing thoughts, making decisions, feeling emotions, and all that has changed.
The team say the data can also be used to improve things like conservation efforts for endangered reptiles, as well as improve the somewhat biblical bad reputation of snakes and show they also have a heart.
That report by Stephanie Prentice. still to come. Is Elton John finally, really, actually calling time on touring around the world?
In 2011, the Fukushima nuclear power plant on the east coast of Japan was struck by a tsunami. It triggered the world's worst nuclear disaster since Chernobyl.
We are in a nuclear emergency!
Fukushima, an original audio drama series from the BBC World Service, tells the story of how the disaster unfolded and of those living with its aftermath.
I'll never be able to separate myself from it.
Catch up with the whole series now by searching for Fukushima wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. In Europe, the Netherlands is facing the prospect of a caretaker government after the coalition that's been led by Prime Minister Mark Rutte for 13 years collapsed. A disagreement over migration policy, that most contentious of issues for the European Union, is to blame. Here's what some on the streets in The Hague think.
Well, it's a pity the government has fallen right now. It's not good for the Dutch environment, the Dutch people. They need stability in this time of economical situation and, of course, the situation with Ukraine.
It sort of seems like they choose more for the best interest of their political party instead of what's the best interest for the country.
Yeah, I'm happy that the possibility for a new government is there. So it gives me hope.
The Netherlands, like other countries in Europe, has been looking at ways to tackle the growing number of migrants who try to cross the Mediterranean. Mr. Rutte, who heads the four-party coalition, met King Willem Alexander in The Hague on Saturday to discuss forming a temporary administration. I spoke to our correspondent in the Netherlands, Anna Holligan, and asked her when we can expect that caretaker government.
Within days. So Mark Rutte met King Willem Alexander at his palace here in The Hague. They were talking for about an hour and a half. And when he left, Mr. Rutte told reporters the discussion had been good, but he wouldn't give any more details because he said they were confidential. So it's hard to say exactly when the caretaker coalition will be formed. But we do know on Monday, Mark Rutte will give a statement to Parliament. And we are expecting after that a pretty heated debate. Really interesting listening to those voices here in The Hague, because it gives you a sense of just how much variety there is, how polarised people are over this. And there has been a lot of speculation about why Mark Rutte has decided to torpedo the coalition in this way, quite dramatic fashion. People saying perhaps there were just irreconcilable differences, not just between the coalition parties, but also within his own party, the VVD, Liberal Conservative VVD. The other thing is he's doing pretty well in the polls right now. So it may be, there is speculation in Dutch media, that he has chosen this as an opportune moment to give himself the best chance of another term in government. So there is a lot going on. Monday, the discussions will continue.
So it's complex, a gamble maybe by the incumbent Prime Minister. Can you just tell us a bit more about the core disagreement at the heart of this over asylum policy?
So the difference between the four parties centred around whether different asylum seekers could be given different rights on when they could bring family members to join them. And we understand that Mark Rutte tried to force through a plan which included a cap on the number of relatives of war refugees who'd be allowed to enter the Netherlands, just 200 per month. The reason why at least two of the coalition partners were unhappy with this, Christian Union is a pro-family party and D66, socially liberal. So Rutte came out and said the situation was regrettable but unavoidable. And, you know, this, as you alluded to, is a situation people, governments are facing right across the EU at the moment.
Anna Holligan in the Netherlands. Hundreds of right-wing protesters have stormed a gay pride festival in the Georgian capital, Tbilisi, forcing its cancellation. The Georgian president and the United Nations have condemned the incident. Will Leonardo has this report.
Up to 2,000 people scuffled with police as they tried to break into the Tbilisi Pride event. Among them were preaching Orthodox priests and people holding up banners reading "Stop promoting homosexual propaganda." Breaking past a police cordon, protesters attacked the stage, stole drinks and burned rainbow flags. The organisers have expressed their shock, accusing some officers of doing little to stop the marauding protesters. Homophobia remains rife in Georgia and LGBT rights have become tied into wider political divisions over relations with the West and Russia. Following the event's cancellation, the president, Salome Zurabishvili, accused the Moscow-leaning governing right-wing Georgian Dream Party for failing to condemn followers who she said had openly propagated hate speech and incited violence.
Now, Latvia made history on Saturday by swearing in the first openly gay head of state for a European Union or former Soviet country. Edgars Rinkevich, the long-serving foreign minister, became the country's new president. Gay marriage is illegal in Latvia, although the country's constitutional court recognised same-sex unions last year. The BBC's Oksana Antonenko in the Latvian capital Riga told us more about Mr. Rinkevich.
Well, he's one of the most experienced politicians in Latvia, and he spent all his life in the public sector. He used to be a civil servant in the Ministry of Defense. He used to work in the president's office. And for the last 12 years, he has been a minister of foreign affairs. So he's very well known in this country as well as in the region in general. A very respected person and a very popular politician.
And what about within Latvia's gay community and beyond? I mean, how much significance is being attached to this moment?
I would say it is a very significant moment for the community because Latvia is very divided and the politicians in Latvia are very divided. There are strong supporters of legalizing gay marriages and there are politicians and, you know, members of the society who are strictly against it. So for this reason, the gay president is a very important figure, and what people expect from him is to push the agenda to legalize gay marriages or at least to talk about it.
So, I mean, has he been a campaigner for gay rights or for equal marriage, or is he going to become a campaigner?
Well, I wouldn't say he was, even though his first tweet, which was something that happened back in 2014, he said that he's gay and he said also that he's going to support legalizing gay marriages. But after that, he was very quiet on this topic. And right after he was elected, he didn't mention it. He didn't bring it up. He didn't talk about it, even though he said that he has an idea about a new law for Latvia. He didn't mention what exactly is going to be. And after he was elected, he didn't talk about it. And even today, when he became a president, in his speech, he didn't bring it up. He didn't mention it at all. The closest he got, he said that every person in Latvia must feel protected and every person in Latvia must feel belonging. But that's it. He didn't directly mention it. He didn't directly push the agenda. Well, I suppose the public expects him to do this after he becomes a president. But up to this moment, I wouldn't say he was a campaigner for gay marriages, even though we know he supports it himself.
Oksana Antonenko in Latvia. For more than 2 billion people across the world, they are part of their daily diet. Insects are packed with vitamins, fibre and minerals, and they can be produced much more sustainably than meat. Recently, the European Union passed legislation approving the sale of insects for human consumption. It's a decision that's likely to encourage even more widespread production. Sofia Battisa reports from Northern Italy.
I'm in the biggest cricket farm in Italy, perched by the Alps near Turin. Here, they turn about 1 million crickets into food every day. First, the crickets, still alive, are frozen, then boiled, dried, and then pulverized into extremely fine bits. And this is the final result. A light brown cricket-based flour that can be added to food, like pasta, bread, or pancakes. And it's good for the planet. Insects require a fraction of the land and water that is used to produce meat. Ivan Albano runs the farm.
What we do here is very sustainable. The impact on the environment is almost zero. To produce 1 kilo of cricket powder, we only use about 12 liters of water, whereas producing the same amount of protein from cows requires about 60,000 liters of water.
But how does this get on your plate? Some restaurants buy the flour and add it to some of the more traditional dishes. I'm in a restaurant watching chef Simone Lotto prepare fresh pasta, using a recipe that is nearly 1,000 years old, but with one twist, an extra 15% of cricket powder.
Cricket pasta?
Yes.
thank you.
Here we go. The chef has just brought in a plate of cricket tagliatelle. This is really good. It tastes like normal pasta. Maybe like whole wheat pasta, a little nutty. I really would not be able to tell that this was made with cricket flour. It's delicious.
There is one problem. It's very expensive, even from Italy Cricket Farm again.
Cricket flour is a luxury protein. It costs about 60 euros per kilo. For example, one bag of pasta can cost up to 80 euros.
That means that insect food is a niche option. And there is another obstacle, social acceptance. The thought of eating insects is unappetizing for many Europeans. But a change of attitude is happening. Austria, Belgium and the Netherlands are the countries that are most receptive to eating insects, with young people being particularly open-minded. A number of studies show that European consumers would be willing to eat insects if they were properly informed about their environmental benefits. And with the EU approving foods made from insects, the prices are expected to go down, which means insects could soon become a part of the European diet.
Sophia Battista with those frozen, boiled and pulverised crickets in northern Italy. Now, have a listen to this. I'm still standing better than I ever did. Looking like a true survivor. Feeling like a little kid. That is the superstar showman Elton John, who has played what he says is his last show on tour. It's the end of more than 50 years on the road. On Saturday night in Sweden, the show that he's been touring since 2018, with some enforced breaks for COVID-19, has finished. As he ended the performance, he told the crowd in Stockholm that he was going to go away for a while. He's reportedly played to 6 million people on this tour alone, with ticket sales of around $900 million. I asked our music correspondent Mark Savage if this really, really was the end.
It's the end of him going on the road, travelling around the world from country to country, private jets, nights and hotels. What he says is that he wants to spend more time with his two young boys in Windsor in the UK, being a dad. But what he hasn't ruled out, and he said this to me, is a residency. So he was very enamoured with Kate Bush's residency in Hammersmith in 2011, where she played a lot of album tracks. It was a very theatrical production. And he says he'd like to do that and concentrate on some of those songs that aren't Rocket Man, that aren't Your Song, and play the deep cuts that he loves, but that big audiences don't want to see.
So not kind of Vegas, but maybe Hammersmith.
Exactly, yeah, somewhere down the road.
Now, I mean, I say this out of the greatest respect, but is the fact is that he's just too old now to do this and to continue to enjoy it.
I mean, watching him in Glastonbury a couple of weeks ago, he looked like he was having the time of his life. I mean, admittedly, his mobility isn't what it was. He had a hip injury last year, and when he came out onto the stage, he was very slow until he sat at the piano. But his playing and his energy were just like they always were. And he was on stage for 2.5 hours. There are a lot of acts half his age that can't play a show that long without a break. I certainly think, I mean, inevitably, as you get older, then those shows do take a toll on you. But, you know, I watched Bruce Springsteen 3 nights ago and he's just about to turn 74. And again, the same energy. I think sometimes when you step out on that stage and there are 100,000 people screaming your name, maybe it just takes you back to a younger time in your life and you get that boost of energy that you would have done in your 20s and 30s all over again.
I mean, just finally, the numbers on Elton are staggering in terms of people he's played to, the amount of ticket sales, but he seems to be going out in terms of touring still on a high, because number 2 in the album chart, I mean, recently he's diversified into, you know, animation, more remix number ones. It's not the end of all that side of his business, is it?
No, absolutely not. And actually, one of the things he said to me, just as this tour was beginning, was that when it ends, he remembers taking a ferry across the Atlantic and writing an entire album in his cabin. Just 3 months, no distractions, no gigs to play. And he said he would really like to just do that again, to sit down and play and write and have the space to be creative without all of the demands of the record industry and the touring machine that surrounds him.
Mark Savage on Elton. Right, that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Nick Randall. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Robin Brandt. Until next time, thank you and goodbye.